Hello and welcome to Real Talk. I'm Susan McCabe, your host, and my music has died. This is the show that I like to say seeks answers to questions large and small. And today, our question could be actually either one. The question is, how do we, in these difficult times, talk with the difficult stranger, someone who might differ from our beliefs? There's a lot of that going around these days. And so I've invited Reverend Paul Mitchell from the Vashon United Methodist Church to join me here and talk about this very subject and see if we can have some practical answers for you listeners. Thank you for being here, Paul. Welcome.
Good afternoon, Susan. Thanks for having me.
It's a pleasure, and I'm going to put you on the spot a lot because we need help.
Oh.
But first of all, I'd like to know a little bit about you. You are fairly new to Vashon Island, correct?
Yeah, I was just noting this past Sunday that I'm just at the beginning of my third year as the pastor at the United Methodist Church here, and looking forward to building on relationships that have developed over these first 2 years. It's sort of been a honeymoon period. And now that we know each other a bit better, we can start to get some things done.
How are you doing things differently from your predecessor, if at all?
Well, my predecessor, Kathy Morse, left a really strong foundation. She was very much beloved by the congregation and was ready to retire. So she was an experienced pastor, knew how to love a congregation and love a community, and she often said that she might have made a better church secretary than a pastor. So the books were in good order as well.
Yeah.
So there's not a lot, I think, that I've done differently, at least not intentionally. Although, especially in a small congregation, we have a little over 60 average worship on Sunday morning. In a small congregation, just a change of personality in the front can change everything.
Yeah, I would think so.
And we're not the same person. For one thing, I had to have little stilts made for the communion table so that it wasn't so low for me. Kathy was shorter than I am.
So, having said that, you are new to Vashon Island. I'm wondering where you were before, and how did you find Vashon?
Well, in the United Methodist system, we have bishops who send us. They tell us where to go.
Oh.
And we are sent a year at a time. We don't know when we arrive, how long we'll be able to stay. I had some indication from the bishop that it might be a longer than average stay, but Methodists are known for maybe a four-year average stay. It's my hope to double that. I have been a pastor since 2002. Before that, I was an architect for 17 years.
Oh, interesting.
In New York City and Los Angeles. And then in response to events after 9/11, I found myself in seminary. I was disturbed by how quickly we went from feeling united humanity around the world to singling out and accusing a particular group of people just because some of their number had done something really atrocious. So I see it as my calling to try and build reconciliation between all kinds of people in the world.
Well, that makes you the perfect person for us to be talking to today about how to speak with the, converse with, connect to the difficult stranger and maybe not be so strange. So I would think working with people to reach some sort of harmony, if you will, is both a spiritual and a practical pursuit. How, in your view, do those two blend in order to help us become a little more harmonious?
Well, here we are in a medium that's all about talking, but it's also about listening, right? And we kind of assume that somebody is out there listening to us as we speak. And so I think the foundation for understanding, for having a conversation, really begins with listening. That's what underlies everything. If we can't listen first, we don't know where we stand. We don't know the other person. And I think that's the foundational aspect of building a good relationship and also working through differences of opinion, being able to really listen first.
Do you see that skill deteriorating among Americans under the current, I'm going to call it cloud?
Mm-hmm. It certainly doesn't seem to be highly valued by a lot of people. And I think it easily, the static easily ratchets up. Especially if we think we have to make our point and change the other person. I think genuine listening doesn't start with that agenda. It starts with an agenda of not even necessarily of understanding, but knowing another person. And that doesn't seem to be highly valued.
I'm wondering, sometimes my sense is that we, if we find out something about a person that we disagree with, we immediately dismiss them.
Yes.
So we don't want to spend the energy to get to know them. We've already written them off. And I wonder how much technology and the ability of technology to put us in silos has affected that. What are your thoughts about that?
Well, I'll tell you, I just recently decided to take my Facebook app off of my cell phone because I would get drawn into these silos, knowing that it was happening, and it was taking up all the air in the room for me, and I needed to let go of that some. So I still have Facebook, and I look at it on my laptop occasionally, but I can choose when I do that. And then I try not to get drawn deeply into those silos.
Yeah, there's some pretty vitriolic things going on. And, of course, this is stating the obvious, but it allows people to do that anonymously or sort of anonymously, or to attribute that vitriol to someone else, some idea that they've shared on Facebook.
Right. Yeah, I think we lose the personal touch. And for me, I mean, I'm not here to do any kind of proselytizing or anything, but I think for me, my motivation is I consider myself to be a follower of Jesus. And I sometimes prefer that terminology to being a Christian, because the word Christian has all kinds of baggage with it. But the reason I follow Jesus is because he was a real person who lived a real life like we do and struggled with the same kinds of issues that we do, but in person. And that's also an important foundation for relationship. We can't really, really know someone until we conspire with them, until we breathe the same breath that they breathe. And the media, especially social media platforms, get in the way of doing that.
Yeah, so much of technology as we have created it over the last century, if you will, has served to isolate us. First, we became nuclear families, and we got into homes where horrible things can happen in isolation, and people are pressured to raise their families alone. And then we got cars, so we weren't walking around or on public transportation. Then we got into phones and social media and all that stuff. And every step of the way, we have become more solitary.
Yes.
And a lot of folks blame technology, which is what we now call social media, for the demise, if you will, of human connection. What, if you've thought of it, would you see as some antidotes to that?
Well, putting down your cell phone. Somebody just showed me a picture, like a road crossing sign, like we have here for deer, right? Or we have here in the center of Vashon at the pedestrian crossings that showed two people walking, looking at their cell phones in silhouette. You know, watch out because these people are unaware of what's happening around them. I think that's one thing that we can do. But also setting aside our need to change the other person. So even if we're engaged in social media platforms, if we can set aside that need to convince and change the other person, I think that would make a big difference for us. I've recently recommitted myself to a period of daily meditation. And that for me is a time of just listening. And it helps me to carry with me through the day then a little bit of space between something that I experience and my response to that. It helps me to say, okay, what's going on here and how do I want to respond? And I'm not perfect. I have a lot of work to do on that. So just this weekend during the festival, I shouldn't be advertising this, but in recent years, the Methodist Church parking lot has been the place where the children's parade starts. Well, I don't know how long that's been going on, but there's no agreement about that. It just happens, right? It's one of the things that happens. And also, we haven't in the past put any kind of restriction on parking in the lot during the festival, except on Sunday morning. So I was in the parsonage, the house for the pastor that's right behind the church on Saturday, and I looked out the window and I saw someone drive into the parking lot and block the way into our driveway at our house. Well, instead of going out and saying, oh, hello, I don't think we've met, I went out and said, would you please not block my driveway? So I think if I had started the other way, if I had started by saying, oh, hello, I would have realized that it was someone bringing something to drop off for my daughter.
Oh, well, yeah, those embarrassing
and
moments.
And then I was embarrassed, right? Yeah. So I think if we can engage in practices that give us a sense of that little space between an experience and our response, that will really help a lot. And that's a listening exercise.
That's very interesting because when I think about how Americans particularly converse, and I'm putting that in quotes, it is an attempt to change the other person or to win.
Right.
An argument rather than to share information or intimate knowledge about a person. And to me, that need seems to come out of some sort of desperation. I desperately need for you to agree with me, or I desperately need to change your mind. Where does that come from? Where is that desperation located in the human psyche?
Yeah, I think it's innate, but I think that it is kind of whipped up to a frenzy at times, and we feel like there's a whole lot at stake. That again, I think that goes back to knowing when we have enough and letting enough be enough and not needing to win anymore. I think that's part of it.
Not needing to win anymore.
Yeah.
And I'm going really off the edge here. Why do we need to win? What's that, to me, an insecurity?
It is. It is, especially if we have enough. And frankly, most of us do.
Yeah.
And it feels to me like many people who are most deeply worried about not having enough or giving up or losing the next argument already have plenty.
Yeah, or too much.
Yeah.
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 You're listening to Real Talk on the Voice of Vashon at 101.9 FM, KVSHLP, Vashon Island, Washington. I'm Susan McCabe, your host, here with you every Tuesday at lunchtime. And I can do this because of the support we get from Windermere Vashon Real Estate, who makes all our community information programming and our emergency alert service possible. Today, I'm talking with Reverend Paul Mitchell from Vashon United Methodist Church about how to speak with what one might call the difficult stranger, or somebody who disagrees with us.
Mm-hmm.
I've heard it said that Americans, unlike Europeans, and it's probably a European who said this, don't have conversations. They have arguments. And we were just talking about that need to win. So how do we make ourselves feel safe enough that we don't need to win?
Yeah. Well, I think hearts are often deeply changed when they do have an encounter with a loved one who they learn is different, or a stranger who they learn is the same.
Ah, that's interesting.
What do we have in common that we didn't realize? And really, most of what we have and are, we have in common. Or what about that person who's close to me did I not know? Persons who, in positions of power, who have opposed various forms of inclusion, for instance, gender inclusion, people who were opposed to marriage equality, for instance, their hearts were changed when they realized that their sibling or their child actually wanted to marry someone of the same gender. And that's what changed their heart, is that mm-hmm. they already had a deeply committed relationship with that person, and they learned something new about them. And a ready example doesn't come to mind for the other side of that coin of learning that we have something deeply in common with someone that we presumed was basically different. And it just all goes back to relationship and being inquisitive about ourself and about the other. I think you were inspired to have this topic because you had read a recent sermon in which
yes.
I said something about having been called, that followers of Jesus are called to love the difficult stranger.
Yes.
And of course, one of the stories that is most well known about Jesus is the parable that he told about the Good Samaritan, which is really, the scholars are asking him, what's the most important law? Can you sum it all up into one thing, right? And Jesus readily said, to love God with our entire being and our neighbor as ourself. And then the scholars thought, oh, we're going to get him. We'll ask him who is our neighbor. And that's when he told the story about the Good Samaritan. It's a familiar story. Somebody's been hurt, left bleeding on the roadside, and the leaders of the day pass by on the other side of the road, and the Samaritan stops. And what most people may not realize is that the Samaritan was the other living in their midst, a foreigner, mm-hmm. Somebody who was of a different religion, somebody who was unclean. And it turns out that that person was the neighbor, right? So that's a little bit of the context of loving the difficult stranger. And that made me think, well, what is love, right? What, at least what is that kind of love? And so I have a little tentative definition. I'm not sure if this will play out very well.
We all look for one, yes.
but to love, at least in this sense, to love is to have the intention and action for the thriving of the beloved. And so part of that is that you have to decide who is the beloved, or discover who is the beloved. And for, I think, people of goodwill and faith who care about the common good, know that we're all beloved.
And we don't necessarily need to be followers of Jesus to get that.
No, not at all.
When I talk about the spiritual and the practical component, you've done a lovely job of packaging those two together. Because I think if you are a human with empathy, it's really impossible to walk past someone in need.
Right.
And not want to help. At least not want to. You may not take the action. I like the idea of intention and action. You may not always take action, but you might the next time.
Right.
Because you felt in your gut this person's pain or this person's difficulty.
I was recently exposed to some writing and thinking by a group called the Arbinger Institute. They published a book called The Anatomy of Peace. And in that book, they suggest that we all have a kind of natural empathy. They didn't use that word, but an impulse for the good of the other, no matter who it is. Mm-hmm. And I can think of some people that it's pretty hard for me, you know, to have that, to sense that impulse, right? A handful. But they suggest that we all have that at heart. That's part of our basic makeup. Otherwise, we wouldn't still be around at all.
True.
As a species. But that in that moment, if we don't give ourselves time enough to have the intention and the action for the good of that other, we might think, oh, but they belong to this group or that group, right? This is the sign they have on their lawn, or this is where they came from. So immediately we make that person into an object.
Yes.
And so they may be an object that is that I can get something from. That's an opportunity for me, right? They may be an object that's an obstacle. They're in my way somehow. Or they're an object just because they're irrelevant, and it's like that empty coffee cup over there. It doesn't really matter to me. Any of those ways, they're an object. And then they stop being a person to me. And then it's very easy to mistreat them or slight them, even in a small way.
And what does that do to my own personal humanity?
Right.
How does my humanity change when I make other humans, whomever they may be, into objects?
Right.
I think that's something that may be overlooked when we go around in a day. I had a friend who used to say, try to get through a day without making a judgment.
Mm. Hard for us to do.
Yeah, without stopping at a stop sign and saying, woman driver. Or without walking down the street, seeing a homeless person and saying, oh, drug addict. Or even smaller judgments like that. Try to get through a day without doing that. That's a big challenge.
It is, but we hardly ever feel good after we've done that.
Right.
Because there's still that little seed inside of us that connects with that other person. And so we have to start to justify our actions. Oh, I know that was wrong, but, right? I did it because, right? I have these other obligations or commitments or whatever. And then to justify our actions, then we start to recruit people into our camp to justify our actions, to say, oh yes, I agree with you, Susan. That was a bad driver, right? And we should let them know. And that snowballs very quickly.
That, to my mind, sort of feeds into the idea of the desperation that I must be right.
Yeah.
I must be right.
Right.
I must, and in order to feel right, I have to have other people telling me I'm right. Oh, that's how huge factions grow.
Right. And it comes, I think, in part from that initial impulse of good toward the other person. We know how we are to behave toward others. That never goes away. And when we violate that innate sensibility, then we have to start to justify it, to make our case.
So when I look at that construct on a global level, there are plenty of folks out there, oligarchs and so forth, who have quite handily made many other humans into objects that they can destroy or manipulate. So what's going on in the psyche and the soul of those oligarchs, those people who have managed to dehumanize so many other humans? Where does that come from?
There are things that happen in life that suggest to us that we may be in danger, right? We may be, we may run out. So I think that's part of it. And again, I'd say it goes back to that. Well, this is not the only impulse, right? We have a tribal impulse. We have an impulse to help those closest to us and that we perceive to be alike us to thrive. And that may mask our sensibility that others who are different from us also have that need to thrive. Those things can bump up against each other. It's not an easy thing to do. This Sunday in my sermon, I said, peace is messy. Peace is way harder than war. It's costlier than war because it's a full-time, everyday commitment that we have to make. And war, just like the person who is an oligarch, can make those unpleasant things go away. They can hold them beyond arm's length. War can do that too, especially the way that wars are waged today with drones and whatever, you know.
You just wipe them out.
Yeah. And they're, we might see it on TV, but we can turn off the TV. Mm-hmm. It's way over there somehow, which is another reason why I think the social media technology undermines our peace, because we don't know each other as real people.
And what about the flip side of this? Social media gives us so much information about the pain that is going on in the world that we really can't do anything about, but we start to carry that weight. So how do we manage to balance the weight of our empathy with that need to protect our basic belief systems, to be right, to assure that we're in the right camp? How do we balance that?
It may seem kind of trite, and maybe it is, but it starts locally. It starts right here and now, I think, where we can make the most impact, and then we can work at expanding our circles of influence. It's a daily practice.
Well, you, Reverend Paul Mitchell, have come to Vashon Island fairly recently from larger cities. What is it that you see about Vashon? We applaud ourselves as being a tightly knit community, one that cares about one another. How do you see it from fresh perspective? How do you see Vashon's sense of community?
Well, it is the smallest community that I've lived in my life, and it has very clear boundaries. It's very clearly bounded. And we do have a lot of really significant things in common, getting on and off the island.
Yeah.
The struggle to have adequate local health care. I could name a whole list of things that really affect us all. But I think that there are a lot of silos also. There are a lot of sort of narrow and deep communities that know each other well and make assumptions about everyone else. Oh, everyone feels this way, Right. And I'm pretty sure that's not the case. One of the little bits of research that I learned before coming here was this survey about political contributions in the United States. And at that time, a few years ago, this zip code had the most left-leaning contributions. I guess that may be because of a handful of people that gave very, very generously to those causes. But it allows us to think, well, that everybody's that way, and it's not the case.
It's not the
case. So when something interrupts that expectation, we get startled, we might get a little scared, and we might back off a little bit and say, oh, that person is really different. What are they doing here?
Oh, no, what am I going to do?
Yeah, yeah. So again, I think it comes back to building relationships and getting to know the difficult stranger.
Perfect. Reverend Paul Mitchell, I want to thank you so much for joining us here on Real Talk. We're out of time. But folks, I just want to mention one thing. We live in this community that we think everybody is the same. Take a moment to talk to somebody you tend to avoid and see if you can have a conversation with them. Thanks for listening.